Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is David Thoreau, and I'm the president of the Independent Institute. I'm delighted to welcome you to our Independent Policy Forum this evening. As many of you know who have been with us before, we hold these events roughly monthly on many different major public policy issues. This evening's program is entitled The War on Drugs, Who is Winning and Who is Losing? I want to take this opportunity to thank some people who helped us with this evening's program. One is Mondavi Winery, who were kind enough to donate the wine, and C's Candies, who donated the chocolate truffles. Also, the Custard Company has been a co-sponsor of our Policy Forum program, this one and many of the others. For those of you also new at the Institute, hopefully you got a copy of the packet when you registered. You'll find information about our program and membership and publications and so forth in there. The Independent Institute is a rather unusual organization. It's a nonprofit academic public policy research institute, and we produce many books, some of which you may have seen upstairs. We also produce a quarterly journal called The Independent Review. The current issue is this one, which is available, but also some of you may be interested, if you're seriously interested in the issue of the war on drugs, of some of the past issues. This one was one of the early issues. This goes back to the first year of our operation for the journal, and has really a seminal piece on the origins of the current war on drugs during the Reagan administration. And it's a piece that I'd highly recommend. Another one that I'd recommend is this issue here, for those of you interested in the issue of privacy and how that might relate to some of these topics. The results of the work that we produce in general are published as books and in the journal and in other studies, and we organize many conference and media programs based on that work. Our interest is to get beyond what most people consider to be left and right, hopefully to get to a more accurate assessment of the nature of politics, of economics, of political economy, domestically and internationally, and we're interested in serious-minded people who can develop information that contributes towards that. I also wanted to point out another study that we did, which I hope we have here. Anyway, this copy is upstairs. It's called Illicit Drugs and Crime. And it's by one of our research fellows, whose name is Bruce Benson, who's also the author of this book called To Serve and Protect, which also deals in part on the drug war. Another study that we did that relates to this is this book here called Taxing Choice. And it deals with the issue of use of taxation and prohibition as a way to control populations in different ways. Many people are not aware of the fact that the Harrison Act, when it was first passed, was actually an excise tax. It was an excise tax on opiates and other drugs, and was only later converted into a prohibition. And part of the reason was allegedly that the excise tax, which engendered a black market in those substances, resulted in the usual crime that people would see, and that then led to calls for even more draconian measures that led to outright prohibition. In your packet also, there's a flyer on this evening's program. Here's a copy of the study that I just mentioned by Benson. In the packet, there's also a flyer on this evening's program, which also lists another upcoming event, which is actually a broadcast of our previous event, which will be this weekend on C-SPAN. Some of you, I recognize, were here last month for the program we did with Robert Stinnett and his book, Day of Deceit. Day of Deceit is a book that's been out for about 6 months from the Free Press. Stinnett is a former journalist with the Oakland Tribune, and he was the person who spent about 16 years, was determined to try and get the actual documents that related to the buildup to the Pearl Harbor attack that led to the U.S. involvement in the European and Pacific War in the 1940s. And the story that he has to say is pretty provocative, to say the least. Anyway, that will be broadcast this weekend on Saturday and Sunday. For this evening, we're very pleased to have three distinguished authors, experts on an issue that is of a widespread interest. It affects people dramatically in a whole range of areas. It touches on economics, it touches on law, it touches on political issues, it touches on U.S. foreign policy. It's really an amazing issue once you start looking at it. And we're delighted to be featuring two books. The first one is the book Whiteout, which is now out in soft cover from Verso. We're delighted that Alex Coburn, one of the co-authors, is here. Unfortunately, his co-author, Jeffrey St. Clair, couldn't make it for personal reasons. The other book that we're featuring is Cocaine Politics, which is from the University of California Press. And both of those authors are here, Peter Dale Scott, who's Professor Emeritus of English from the University of California, Berkeley, and Jonathan Marshall, who is former economics editor at the San Francisco Chronicle. So I hope that each of you can get copies of those books before you leave. Before we begin, I'd like to share a few recent news events. And those of you who are familiar with these events, I apologize for mentioning them again, but I think they're somewhat germane. This past Wednesday, Governor Ben, I guess it's Cayetano, of Hawaii, signed a bill decriminalizing the use of medical marijuana. Although similar laws have been passed, as many of you know, in seven states and the District of Columbia, Hawaii is the first state where the laws were enacted by a state legislature rather than a ballot initiative, as it was in California. Recent polls have found that 73% of Americans favor legalizing the medical use of marijuana. Yet the federal government is yet to recognize any of these actions on the state level. Number two, despite this trend, also this past week, the crusading medical marijuana activist Peter McWilliams suddenly died. The 50-year-old McWilliams was the author of numerous very popular personal growth and self-help books, as well as collections of poetry and photography, but he may be best known for his influential book, Ain't Nobody's Business If You Do. He, like so many others who were suffering from AIDS, had found that using marijuana was highly effective in reducing the nausea caused by the AIDS drugs he was taking. However, although Prop 215, the California Medical Marijuana Initiative, passed overwhelmingly, federal drug and tax agents stormed his home and offices on December 17, 1997, confiscating all of his manuscripts and equipment and effectively shutting down his publishing business. He self-published his book. As his battle with federal authorities dragged on, Williams' home life and health deteriorated, to say the least. Barred from using Prop 215 or evidence of the value of medical marijuana as defenses in a federal courtroom, he was forced to plead guilty. Awaiting sentencing and forbidden to use marijuana by the court, McWilliams was unable to hold down his AIDS medication. As a result, his viral count soared, and he spent long hours in bed fighting nausea. Being unable to work, he defaulted on bankruptcy payments and then lost his home. His subsequent death was that he choked as a result of his nausea. Number three, many of you are probably familiar with the recent article in the New Yorker by the investigative reporter and author Seymour Hersh that has raised serious questions about American actions at the end of the Gulf War, including allegations that American troops fired on hundreds of disarmed Iraqi prisoners, many of whom were wounded and others who were trying to surrender. In one of these accounts, the forces under the command of General Barry McCaffrey moved his forces to deliberately provoke a battle with retreating Iraqi forces who were already following Allied guidelines on how to withdraw from the war zone. McCaffrey has denied every one of these accounts. However, ABC News has since reported that perhaps as many as 200 to 300 of the surrendering Iraqis who had been disarmed in an area known to hold disarmed prisoners were shot and killed by a group of 14 Bradley fighting vehicles which suddenly appeared and opened up and fired on them. Bradleys were from the 1st Brigade of the 24th Infantry Division under the command of General McCaffrey. To this day, the Army has not even interviewed the crews of all the Bradleys, and those who submitted statements have denied that the incident had occurred. In fact, Colonel John LeMoyne, commander of the 1st Brigade, has claimed that, quote, the Iraqi soldiers were never shot at, ever, at that point, none of us, hundreds and hundreds of us, ever saw a body, none of us, unquote. Meanwhile, one of the soldiers involved in the disarming of the Iraqi soldiers has produced an audio tape recording of the entire incident. No doubt General McCaffrey's particular leadership during the Gulf War was a major reason for his being named Drug Czar by President Clinton. The war on drugs is a war on people. And who better to head up such a war than the old general himself? For decades now, the U.S. government has waged a relentless war on the use of marijuana, opiates, and many other substances. Yet illicit drugs today are more plentiful than ever. How could that be? The war on drugs is global in scope. It has costed who knows how many billions of dollars. The war has produced mandatory bank deposit disclosures, government surveillance, civil asset forfeiture laws, prison overcrowding is an understatement, encryption software restrictions, rampant police and political corruption, the wholesale trampling of constitutional liberties by the DEA, CIA, FBI, INS, and other agencies. The format of our program tonight will be to have each of our speakers speak for about 15 minutes. Afterward, we'll open it up for Q&A. And let's begin. Our first speaker is Alexander Coburn, born and raised in Ireland. He's a syndicated columnist for the Los Angeles Times, co-editor of Counterpunch, and we have copies here that Alex kindly brought of, I guess, it's the current issue of Counterpunch.
The recent issue,
and everyone is, until we run out, welcome to take copies. He's also a columnist for The Nation. He graduated with honors from Oxford University in 1963 with a degree in English literature and language. After 2 years as an editor at the London-based Times Literary Supplement, he worked at the New Left Review and the New Statesman. A permanent resident of the U.S. since 1973, Alex wrote for many years for the Village Voice about the press and politics. Since then, he's contributed to many publications, including the New York Review of Books, Harper's, The Atlantic, and the Wall Street Journal, where he held authored a regular column for 10 years during the 1980s. In addition to his book by Jeffrey St. Clair, which I just mentioned, called Whiteout, he's the author of many, many other books, including Corruptions of Empire, The Fate of the Forest, Night Watch Over Nature, The Golden Age is in Us, Washington Babylon, and on. I'm very pleased to introduce Alex Coburn.
Thank you very much, David. I do like these. He mentioned the trying to get beyond right and left. I think there are things that separate right and left. But I think there are many areas and many topics where people who might come out of different chunks of the political spectrum can really talk. Drugs is one of them. Anti-war activities are another. I think the current debate over hate crimes is something that might bring people from the libertarian end and from the left end together. And I think we are in a period of flux, hopefully creative flux in our political life. I'm come from the left end of the spectrum, and there's no people more dedicated to staying in their own quarters and not putting their heads over the parapet too much than people on the left. And that's true of other crowd as well. And anything that gets people out and shakes them up a bit, in my estimation, is to be applauded. And I think the libertarian end and the Independent Institute should be congratulated for doing that. And the more we do it, the better we'll be off. So here we are talking about the drug war. Who's winning, who's losing? And we'll answer the question, I think, right away. And then you can all leave. The state is winning, the state. And the people are losing. The rationale ultimately for drug wars is the interests of the state. You're looking at three authors here who've done books which have discussed extensively the role of intelligence agencies, the CIA, in facilitating, participating in, covering up for, sponsoring the trafficking in illegal drugs. And Peter Dale Scott will go into some of the minutiae of that later on. But one thing should be made clear, I think, is, from my point of view, the thing to remember, occasionally there's a misleading phrase, the CIA a rogue agency. It's not. It doesn't do things, by and large, without the absolute sanction and okay of the government. So when the CIA is doing those things with drug, it is operating as an executive agency of government. And I would like to remind people that the history of government roles in advancing the sale and smuggling of drugs is a very ancient one. I won't go back through it, but the British, of course, attacked China in the 19th century in two wars to ensure that they could sell opium in China. Savage wars in the interests of the free market. That was a drug war to make the Chinese accept. The Chinese emperor and his government were opposed. They said, we don't want this drug destroying our people. British said, well, it's the free market, buddy. And they went at it. From the very inception of the CIA, and in the years before the CIA was created, in this sort of Second World War period, there was an intimate association between U.S. intelligence agencies and criminal organizations in smuggling drugs into this country. There are structural reasons for that. To wit, that intelligence agencies have a need for criminal elements to do some of the dirty work they don't want to do themselves. By and large, criminal organizations and intelligence agencies are right-wing, pro-capitalist, anti-insurgency, anti-left. Their interests are very often common. And so you can go through post-war history from the association of naval intelligence and the OSS, this is before the CIA was created, with Luciano and the mafia, to the earliest days of the CIA and the nationalist Chinese, to Southeast Asia, the association of the agency with drug smuggling, trafficking, producing gangs, their need to recruit workers from small hill tribes in the Burmese Triangle, those identity of interest which led to direct connivance and assistance and oversight by the Central Intelligence Agency into bringing drugs into this country. You can take that history forward through Afghanistan. You can take it with Burma. You can take it with Kosovo. Right now, the U.S. Senate is debating an aid bill. They're looking at about $1 billion. The House, I think, passed $1.8 billion to send military supplies, which they're obviously already sending illegally as it is. This is, so to speak, only a formal imprimatur onto what is undoubtedly happening already. You'll recall that for many years they said there were only 56 U.S. advisors in El Salvador, and then about a few years ago they said, well, actually it was several thousand. Not one word they ever say about personnel abroad and this passage of arms abroad can ever be believed for one second, ever. Under no circumstances should you ever believe anything of that nature when articulated by the U.S. government. It's not worth the paper it's written on. What are the structural objectives of this? Well, obviously the drug war abroad is a counterinsurgency war. It's another method of repressing threats to empire, threats to the American interest. It's a way of fortifying the allies of the U.S. abroad. The rationale, for example, in Colombia, they think there might be some resistance if they say, you know, this is a straight counterinsurgency. People might say, well, you know, another Vietnam, for God's sake. You're really going to get into that? So they've done it more and more under the rationale of the narco-terrorist gangs, combining all the bugaboos. You have the bugaboo of drugs, you have the bugaboo of terrorists, and you roll them all into one. And that's what we're waging war on. General McCaffrey, as David pointed out, is pretty much a certified war criminal. I mean, not a big one, a sort of middle-sized war criminal. I mean, we've got several bigger ones around, let's face it. I've been astounded, actually, but even by our degenerate standards, the lack of commotion. It was an extremely well-argued, well-researched, I thought irrefutable piece by Seymour Hersh in the New Yorker magazine has roused a remarkably little stir. They don't say, General McCaffrey, war criminal. General McCaffrey, drug czar and war criminal. Maybe part of the working title for the job in future. So, and we can see what will clearly happen now. The stage is being set up for our drug war in Colombia. The latest issue of Counterpunch, not quite out, actually has a very good story now. They are now already unleashing bio-war on the Colombian coca growers. A bio-war that may easily affect yams, will spill over from the coca. There'll be an absolute ecological catastrophe. For those of us who like to feel that we're in the post-Cold War phase, and that's an encouraging sign, they're actually using former Soviet biotechnicians to make their various biotoxins in the former Soviet Union. It's an encouraging sign of how we've moved on to a more global approach to world's problems. That's Colombia. Domestically, and that's, I think, an area where Mr. Marshall will review the domestic costs. What has the function of a drug war been? It's clearly been to repress and control, social repression, social control of what a French historian once described as the dangerous classes, or the potentially dangerous classes. I don't know how many people here have had an opportunity to read the findings of the so-called Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. An amazing and horrifying saga of what the apartheid government was doing, very often with CIA connivance, by the way, and active support, in its war against South African black people. A large part of it, they had a very extensive program of trying to make sure that the townships had a constant supply of drugs of one sort or another. They saw the socially pacifying function of drugs. They also explored greatly the mind-altering function of drugs, which was an area, of course, that the CIA was deeply involved with from the late 40s on. Government agencies have always been completely obsessed with the utility of drugs as a method of social control, social persuasion, social control, rationale for increased policing. And the costs, and Jonathan will enumerate them, he told me before that's what's going to be his specific area, have been gigantic, as we all know. We have a vast prison population, a huge number of people in there for nonviolent drug crimes. We have the attrition of civil liberties. We have all the rationales which David briefly mentioned, from spying, encryption, you name it. Governments love rationales like that. There are other ones they use. Terrorism, by the way, is one that's shackled at the ankle with the drug war as another way of destroying civil liberties and constitutional protections. So the state has been waging these drug wars since, I guess, the first war in the Bay Area against the Chinese in the 1870s, when they passed a law, against opium smoking, which allowed them to expel summarily the Chinese they brought over to build the railroads and dig the mines and the rest of it, and they wanted to get rid of them because there was an economic depression. And so what did they do? They had a drug law aimed specifically at the Chinese. For the middle class people, all our great grandparents who were sipping their little tonics, as my great grandmother did, all the various little opiates that people had, they were not brought in There was a disproportion there, and that was one of the first drug wars we had. So where are we in this drug war? There's obviously widespread public disillusion and dismay about it. I think most people at some level, first of all, the sheer number of casualties in the drug war probably mean that most people know someone, have heard of someone, or a relative of someone who is doing long time in a penitentiary somewhere. Maybe not so much in the upper rungs of society, but certainly in the lower rungs of society. And I think we are, on the one hand, we have an increasingly berserk administration of the war by McCaffrey and forces. You know, there's hardly a day goes out. We've just discovered that the drug czar's office has, when people visit the drug site, then their computers are promptly sort of invaded by some little bug type thing designed and put in by the public relations firm that handles the White House drug czar's business. You know, you read this on an almost daily basis. On the other hand, when resolutions or action of the Hawaiian legislature come up, there's clear public support for a different way. People aren't dumb. They know perfectly well that, you know, all of this enforcement has not reduced by a kilogram, by an ounce, the amount of cocaine arriving in this country. I was living in Key West when the first Bush drug laws came in. Key West in those days was a marijuana town with all the relaxed attitude that marijuana implies. And then, of course, the laws meant that the smugglers had to produce smaller packets to make it easier for themselves, so it went to cocaine. And Key West went to hell as a result, I have to say. But people know when they read that the feds have seized, or the LAPD, or someone has seized 18 tons of cocaine in a warehouse, they think, you know, if they seize that, how much is getting into this country? Brilliant speech, Key, please keep going. Thank you. You almost never get that from a guy, you know? So I think people are ready for anything. They're ready to say, give it a different way. Anyone coming forward with proposals will get a ready reception, I think. This is the wrap-up, don't worry, David. We have on the ballot now, California, an initiative which purports to emphasize the treatment side as opposed to the incarceration side for drug offenders. Actually, I wrote myself a critique of it because I think it's not particularly well thought out, because I think there is something that maybe, and I'll leave this as a thought for you. Drugs are, I believe, and I may differ from people here, there can be a major social problem. Booze can be a social problem. You know, families that are screwed up by alcohol aren't pretty sights. It's a public health issue. As we hopefully move towards recognition of the drug problem, of people afflicted by drug addiction, by families cursed by problems arising from drug addiction, as we face what are the correct and sensible ways of dealing with this, I think we'll be at a very important stage of policy formation, to use a rather pompous phrase. And I think sometimes I fear what will happen, of course, is that people will be so maddened by the drug war, they'll say, to hell with the whole goddamn thing. Tear all the laws down. But you will be left with a problem. How do you deal with that problem? I think, personally, the drug courts, such as I know of them, are pretty good. People may have different ideas. But I think, as we look at these various aspects of drug wars, we shouldn't forget that one, that it is our bounden duty, first of all, to attack the rationalization and use of drug laws by the state, and secondly, to think, what is the socially responsible way of dealing with the drug problem as a social issue and a health issue? Thank you.
Thank you, Alex. I don't want to cut you back, but to get everybody in and then get to the Q&A, I'm afraid I have to